giving me this opportunity to speak here, I think for the first time, maybe not the last, but at least tomorrow is looks promising in this respect. Okay, so and yeah, so I'm grateful for giving me this opportunity, and I decided to use it to kind of, you know, describe parts of long-term project which I have for many years now, which concerns two-dimensional Ising field theory in the magnetic field, and more specifically, associated particle theory. Well, yeah, particle theory. So, first of all, the project itself is basically designed to understand this this field theory itself. And I will try to say a few words why I'm interested in that. The parts which I'm going to expose are mostly, I selected them for sort of, you know, sort of mostly for entertaining value. Although, I mean, I don't know, at least one person is in this audience is going to be entertained. All right, but in some ways you could think of it as commercials. Commercials are supposed to be entertaining, but maybe irritating as well. All right, so that's the title of the talk. As I said, I'm going to speak about Ising field theory. I think I don't need to explain much what Ising field theory is, or at least Ising model is. But that's that by definition is the scaling limit of Ising model in a magnetic field. I'm going to talk about two dimensions, always in a magnetic field. This is just usual noises which are produced when saying Ising model. Everyone knows what it is, but I just want to say that irrelevant of the specific lattice realization, which just this picture shows, supposed to show, the associated there is a Curie point and there is a scaling limit, this critical point, there is a scaling limit. It defines Euclidean or generally quantum field theory. And the Curie point itself is associated with conformal field theory, which is one of the known minimal models of two-dimensional conformal field theory. So that's a general setup. But I want to, of course, if I'm not interested only in the critical point itself, away from it, it's massive quantum field theory, and from the point of view of statistical mechanics, it describes universality class, general universality class of two-dimensional Curie. Whose representatives are two-dimensional Curie point and also liquid, basic liquid vapor transition in two dimensions. So it determines basically scaling functions, correlation functions, and stuff like that in the vicinity of that critical point. So that's a kind of possible application of that. But also being a massive quantum field theory, it defines a particle theory. So the theory of interacting relativistic particles with certain mass spectrum, of stable particles, resonance states, scattering amplitudes, and so forth. Now, first question, which I keep asking myself, even after years of working on that subject, is why one would one want to know answers to to any questions concerning that? Before trying to answer this question, let me just show you a picture. That's a pattern of masses, the masses of various particles in the theory plotted versus some parameter which I'm going to define in a few minutes. But at least in this picture, it must be clear that it's not exactly trivial. There is a, depending on the parameter, there is a varying number of particles. Even if we think of stable particles and so forth. And again, I mean, after looking at this pattern, basically I rephrase the same question, which is why would we want to know, understand this pattern in some ways? And there are two. I will give you two sort of answers to this, or attempt to give you couple of answers, one is that there is a laboratory experiment. This is a laboratory experiment concerning certain chains, certain compounds, which in this particular case, which I mean, there are several things, but the best I think is relatively recent. It involves some ferromagnetic compound, including cobalt and oxygen and stuff. And the properties of the compound are such as that the molecules form long chains. And so in very good approximation, the low energy part of the theory is described by this spin chain. And of course everyone knows that this spin chain is the same is as a Ising model. If you treat one of these dimensions as space and another dimension, let's say vertical dimension, as time, and do some transformations, the standard Ising model reduces to exactly this spin chain. So this is something which you or some really skillful people mentioned here can manufacture in the laboratory, and then one could take a look at the spectrum of excitations here. So here there is I show the plot. Well, I copy the plot of dynamic autocorrelation function in the omega space, and it shows a number of peaks, which of course are associated with excitations, and positions of these peaks are related to the masses of the particles in this chain, and as you see, some of them are very prominent. So one could measure the masses of these particles. Well, not really all of them, but a couple of lowest particles are shown here, and I compare it to the plot, which is basically mirror reflection of the plot I have shown a few slides ago here. So you reflect it because I had to reflect it because I don't know how to reflect this one. It's some sort of magnetic field. All right, the way to control parameters in this chain is to put this thing in the magnetic field. So you change magnetic field, the parameters change. You first of all, I hate to enter the details because it's a subject in itself. So you first have to hit the critical domain, right, and then change the parameters so that you
proportion in some way together. Right.
That's of course very difficult because the critical domain is small and so forth, and you need long. And there is a finite size chain and stuff. So I don't want to. So take it as a kind of God given part. All right. So that's a theory and experiment point of view on that sort of, but. But really, the real reason for me to be interested in that is sort of that here we are dealing with a full-fledged, non-perturbative, strongly interacting field theoretic system, which is not in generally, except for some special points in the parameter space, which I will mention, which is not integrable, so no exact solution exists, and it's probably not really reasonable to hunt for exact solution in general case. So in this situation, the question is how to understand this theory. In fact, very very general and qualitative understanding of the particle spectrum, of stable particle spectrum, exists for a long time, and it's again, I think everyone knows here. It goes by the name McCoy-Wood scenario, but that's a very beautiful way to explain the general structure. But it leaves aside many, in fact, interesting details, and I want to pull couple of these details and expose them here, or try to expose them here. And so the question, the main question for me in addressing this kind of theory is to what extent we can really understand the theory, which is not really integrable or perturbative or imagine not even supersymmetric. All right, so I will discuss, just like I said, I will discuss a couple of features, and my basic tools will be something non-existent. Numerical analysis is existent. I will not explain how numerical analysis is done. Again, it's subject in itself, but it produces something about spectrum with good accuracy. Now, there are integrable points, the points of the parameter space where the theory is integrable, and closed solution can be obtained, at least for some quantities. And so one of the tools will be to use some sort of analytic interpolation between the integrable points. Another one is some funny feature of some of the resonance states in this theory, which can be explained in terms of integrability of some subsystem. I will come back to that. So it's sort of potpourri of some details of that that my talk is going to be, let me start the music. All right, so I will not, of course, deal with lattices or chains or whatever. I will understand this field theory in renormalization group terms as a as a flow, RD flow out of fixed point, which is defined by this minimal conformal field theory, the C equal to 1/2 conformal field theory, which is associated with the critical point here. And this field theory, this conformal field theory, has two relevant scalar fields, which are conventionally denoted as epsilon and sigma, correspondingly energy density and spin density, which couple to two parameters, which is the deviation from the critical temperature, essentially, and it will play role of mass scale. Well, everything plays the role of mass scale here because those are dimensionful, and the H is essentially the magnetic field. All right? So those have some dimensions determined by conformal field theory, and there is a single dimensionless parameter, which I denote eta. It's proportional to the deviation from the critical temperature, made dimensionless by using the magnetic field. All right, so that, just like I said, generically such theories is massive, except for few points, actually two points, in which is when both of these parameters are zero, which is then the conformal field theory, the fixed point associated with the Curie transition. And also there is another point, if you turn on imaginary magnetic field, take a pure imaginary magnetic field, this is well known again in the theory of Ising model, you can flow down to some non-unitary fixed point, which is associated with so-called Young-Li edge singularity. I might be able to touch a little bit parts of that theory, but it's not really likely. But okay. So anyways, it's generic. What the message is, it's generically massive theory, just like I say. Now, yes.
What if magnetic field is random?
It's a very interesting question. That is one of classic problems of statistical mechanics, and I don't think I am going to bring up anything useful in that context today. So the boundary is very sort of, yeah, but that's an interesting question. If I did have something new to report on that, I mean, be sure. Okay, so McCoy-Wood scenario. So it starts with H equal to zero and Zagier's solution of Ising model, which of course is easily translated to the scaling domain. It says that Ising field theory is a free field theory. It's described by free fermion Lagrangian, and therefore in the massive case, it is a theory of free particles, all right, of some mass m, which happens to be the same m as the parameter in the previous transparency. And although this is, depending on the sign of this parameter, interpretation is different. If you have one sign of the parameter, it is interpreted as a single vacuum unbroken symmetry theory, and the particle which I'm talking about, free particle, is just a single excitation over that vacuum. But if the parameter is of different sign, the obvious Z2 symmetry is spontaneously broken. There are two vacua. That's exactly the nature of the transition between this unbroken phases, and so there are two vacua, and this free particle which I'm talking about is exactly the kink, is interpreted as a kink interpolating, sitting in the in between of regions filled with these two vacua. Now, the basic idea of Makko and Wu was that if I, in this situation, if I take low start with low temperature where there are two vacua, okay, and turn on a weak magnetic field, then it, that creates a, well, basically you have a, roughly speaking, you have an at zero magnetic field, you have an ensemble of regions filled with plus and minuses here, and once you turn on the weak magnetic field, the statistical weight of each of these droplet now is suppressed as an exponential of the area with some small coefficient, and that creates a weak confining force between these two. Between a couple of kinks, so the kinks become analogous to quarks in QCD in some ways, in some limited sense, but still it's a confining interaction, and that changes spectrum dramatically. So if you that's the way to one way to understand it is to is in terms of two-point analytic structure of two-point autocorrelation function, spin-spin correlation function. So if you look at the Fourier transformed thing and start with the low temperature domain with zero magnetic field, you have branch cuts from 4 m squared and higher because of the so if I have two spins and they are inside some droplet, you can have two quarks or four quarks in the intermediate state, and that creates all these singularities. That's normal thing. It's a free theory, but we are measuring some correlation function. Now, when small magnetic field is applied, the area factor here makes these particles permanently confined, and as a result, the two quark branch cut breaks into a large number of poles associated with the bound states. This permanent confinement creates a bound states, which I will often refer to as mesons because they are analogous to QCD mesons. All right, so this is the beginning of it. Now, when this is a parameter eta, which is infinite when the magnetic field is zero. Now I make a magnetic field stronger and stronger. This parameter gets smaller, and the particles here, the mesons, they eventually get absorbed into the continuous spectrum, turning into the resonance states. And eventually, near zero, there is a quite few, very few stable particles. And at the end of the day, just one particle remains, which in the limit eta equals to minus infinity becomes this free particle again. In this case, this is the nearest threshold must be 9 m1 squared because there are three particles, but that's details, it's typo here. M1 is m again. Anyways, that's how the spectrum interpolates between free particles and free particles, going in between through some interesting moves. What's that?
Oh, the M1 particle, eta is minus infinity. What does it look like in terms of the
isotropy? Well, you have now unbroken symmetry, right? You have now single vacuum, and that's which happens to have a single type of excitation, And that, again, happens to be a free particle. That's how Anzeiger's solution translates here. Okay. But of course, in between, it's nothing, nothing similar to free theory. All right. So, anyways, I bring up this this picture again. Now, I already explained what the parameter here is, and this pattern now exactly corresponds to this picture which I produced on the previous transparency. The only thing which I added here is exact spectrum at e to equal zero, which is one of the integrable points, and I will come back to that in a few minutes. All right, so to be specific, I will refer to my particles. So I we see that there are number of particles, their number and masses change, but I will denote them A sub n, and the corresponding masses are denoted m sub n, or m sub n of eta. So if I look at this picture again, I can ask you a simple question. What happens when this particles, so this is this dotted line is twice the lightest mass. Once any of these masses touch this this threshold of stability, the particle is no longer stable against decay to lighter particles, and so that's all right. So what happens when to the particles when they go through this line? And so basically, one expects them to become resonances, but there is an interesting question: how exactly this happens? And then, even after that, one can ask that. I mean, clearly, and we will see why some resonances, many resonances, in fact, disappear, and how it is possible, how it this happens. I mean, disappear when you change the parameter, of course. So all these questions, in general, boil down to analytic properties of the masses as the functions of complex eta. All right, now a little bit of technicality, and that is it's in fact the spectrum, the its structure, and resonances as well, everything. It is useful to discuss in terms of two-body elastic scattering amplitude. All right, so you have the lightest particle A1, which is the bottom curve in this previous transparency, is always there. So we can consider two to two scattering of these particles and define elastic scattering and amplitude by this formula, except for the inelastic term which appear here are always present. Well, I mean, except for the integrable points, of course, are present and generally make things complicated. Now, theta here is the rapidity of each individual particle, but theta difference between them is related to center of mass energy by usual. All right, so because of this inelastic channels, there are of course inelastic thresholds and so forth. So one can, as usual by optical theorem, one can relate the imaginary parts or discontinuities to total cross sections, inelastic cross sections. That's standard thing. It's very standard. It's textbook thing. I'm spending few minutes to translate it into the language of rapidity variables. So this scattering amplitude satisfies some identities related to unitarity, crossing symmetry, and so forth, which makes it into a periodic function of the rapidity difference. So I can limited attention to what I call a principal strip. And here, alpha is imaginary theta. So alpha is imaginary theta. I use this notation all the time in the pictures, because otherwise the pictures didn't fit well the slides. All right, so there are standard properties which I just kind of rewritten in terms of this more convenient variable. But anyway, apart from this, the inelastic thresholds are along this real theta axis or imaginary alpha axis and so forth. There are also poles and zeros related to bound states, virtual states, resonance states, as usual in relativistic scattering theory. I wanted to pay attention to the fact that this is a crossing symmetry condition which relates the values of the function in the right-hand side and left-hand side parts of this picture. So one can, in principle, pay attention only to the so-called physical strip, which is basically physical sheet of the Riemann surface in the energy plane, again, as a standard in textbooks. And there, any pole in the domain should correspond to bound state in one or the other or another channel of scattering. And I will refer to the other strip where this strip as a mirror strip, because everything, poles are reflected as zeros in there and so forth. That's how unitarity condition works. Anyways, this is typical pattern of zeros and poles here. You could have bound state poles in the principle, in the physical strip, associated zeros here. Poles in the mirror strip are maybe interpreted as resonances, and so forth. All right. So also the poles which sit in the physical strip, they must have in some sense positive residues. There are two copies of each bound state, which is bound state in direct channel and cross channel, and bound state in direct channel has to have positive residue. That's unitarity, standard thing. So I just try to say that shortly, and I will use always the I will often use this if theory is such that a particle A can appear in the as some sort of bound state of a pair of itself, then it's it's commonly, I think, referred as phi to the cubed property for obvious reasons. Then there are some fixed position poles in the appropriate places of the physical strip, and obviously resonances can have complex masses. And so are going to have complex masses, and the residues are also complex. So now the integrable points. There are actually three and probably exhaustive. This is exhaustive list of integrable points in this theory. And I will start with the most complicated of them. This is what happens when you take M, which is essentially deviation from the critical temperature, right? It would be zero, but keep a non-zero magnetic field. It turns out that it is an integrable theory which involves 8 stable particles. I say it has E8 structure, although to be precise, I cannot exactly say what it means. But at least some signature of the root lattice of E8 is manifest in the spectrum, in scattering amplitudes, in everything. And so, for instance, the masses of stable particles are proportional to the components, to the entries of the Perron-Frobenius matrix of Lie algebra E8. All right, and here is the one of the amplitudes, this exactly amplitude which I mentioned before. It happens to have three bound state poles. In fact, six poles in the physical strip because of the cross channel, but essentially three bound state particles, which correspond to A1, A2, and 3. This A1 is this fixed pole, which I already mentioned, phi to the cube property, and there are two more. There are, of course, the rest of the particles are not visible in this amplitude. They appear in the higher amplitudes, in the multiparticle amplitudes. But there is something special about the three particles over here, and I will mention that. So here is the pattern of zeros and poles in this particular point, integrable point, where you have, as I said, six poles sitting in the physical strip, and the marked are the direct channel poles with positive residue. Of course, residues of these poles alternate, all right, so that's the pattern. Now, let me mention another integrable point, which is a trivial integrable point. It corresponds to zero magnetic field. And in that case, as I mentioned, those are free particles. So the corresponding scattering amplitude is just -1. And I don't know how to draw the pictures, that pattern of zeros and poles of one. That's why I didn't do that. All right? So if you want, you can think of this part of the slide as this pattern. Okay? So one thing which I want to entertain at least myself with today is to speculate, or in fact even describe, how this rather complicated pattern turns into this less complicated pattern. As I evolve the parameter eta from 0 to, let's say, minus infinity. Minus infinity is a zero magnetic field, high temperature domain. There is another part of the story when you interpolate between this and low temperature domain, where all these weakly coupled mesons are. That part of the story is infinitely more complicated. And unfortunately, I have very few things to say about it. But it's, of course, more interesting. Nonetheless, I will limit myself to this easier part of it. All right? So let's see how it goes. First, if I write it this way, the first two terms is integrable theory, which corresponds to this E8 theory, E8 S matrix, and then one can take this as another term as a perturbation, and this is so-called form factor perturbation theory. It's difficult, but one can do it and see how these parameters, which show where the poles sit, change when you in the some leading orders in the perturbation theory. This was done by this. Involved, but it was done by this people long, long ago, and it shows basically that the corrections are proportional to eta with positive coefficients, so that when you go from eta equals zero to negative eta, having in mind to reach the other integrable point eta equals to minus infinity, they basically, this marked poles, they move to the left. All right? Except for the first one, of course, which is a fixed point, well, this is a fixed pole associated with the particle itself. It sits put all the time.
But it ultimately
disappears. Yeah, it will. all right, so that's how it moves. And so this pole alpha 3, which corresponds to particle A3, is very soon, it's about to hop from the physical strip to the mirror strip and to disappear from the spectrum. This actually happens. And indeed, if you look at this picture, the particle M3 is disappearing very soon after. This is zero, this is integrable point, and I move to the left. It disappears over here. Okay? So nothing unexpected happens here. So this is a picture already after this pole already hopped to the other part and became a virtual state. So the way it disappears is shown there, and it shows in fact that this a point where this particle disappears is not any singularity. It's just a regular point. If you analytically continue, I didn't do the picture, but if you analytically continue M3 in eta, it just smoothly continues over this point. In fact, it make a tangent. Its curve is tangent to the curve. That's a typical picture how bound state becomes a virtual state, and so forth. All right. So, but what I want to pay attention at is this. Now let's look at the other pole. This keep this sits put. This moves to the left. So it is about to hop over the cross channel image of this phi to the cubed A1 pole phi to the cubed. But if it did simply hop around it, it would change the sign of the residue, right? So that's forbidden. So what the only way to save the game is for the zero, which is the mirror image of this pole, is to rush to the rescue and hit the same point at the same time. And that's exactly what happens. And so I will show the picture. So that's the next step. So these two poles interchanged places, and the zero, which used to be here, rushed through. And here there is a plot of numerical data associated with this ratio of masses, and the solid curve represents some sort of result of some analytic interpolation. That's some sort of dispersion relation where you assume some analytic properties and make an interpolation this way. And in order for them to hit each other, for this funny event to happen, is that this curve crosses this point. You see that it happens. So this is part of consistency picture, and basically this is how it happens. So far there is no singularity. The first singularity occurs when these two points, alpha 3, hit each other and then deviate into a complex plane. All right, so this is the way they become resonance states. So that's typical way how resonances not typical, but one of the ways how resonances appear. And then I can continue. I'm kind of running out of time, so I have to rush. Nothing particularly new happens. You have to only to follow how these poles move in such a way that once they intersect each other, the violation of positivity of residue doesn't happen. So it's possible to arrange that. And that way, one sort of reproduces the overall pattern. At certain point, the pole alpha 2 also moves into the mirror half, and then it continues to move to the left. And here we go. You could see what is about to happen. These circles are mirrors of the phi to the cube poles in the physical strip. These are zeros, and eventually this alpha 2 things would annihilate with these zeros and create this complicated pattern here. All right, so this in fact is interesting to follow, to extend this pattern to the imaginary values of magnetic field and get in touch the flow of kind of deformation from the integrable point of free particles to the integrable, another integrable point which I didn't mention is a Young-Lee singularity. All right, it's also it turns out to be integrable. There is scattering matrix and so forth. But I think I will just skip it. It happens more or less the same way. It shows appearance of more resonances and so forth. So let me just get to the point of resonances, and the pattern of resonances in this theory, of course, is very complicated. But I will describe just a few features again for their entertainment values of the physics of resonance state in this theory. All right, let me come back to this E8 integrable point, which appears to at eta equals zero. And so we have 8 stable particles, of which 3 are, we already discussed them, but the remaining, how many? 8 minus 3, 5. Remaining 5 particles are above the stability threshold, so their stability at this point is entirely due to the presence of higher integrals of motion, which sort of forbid decays. So once you break integrability even a little bit, they become unstable and turn into resonances. This can be computed perturbatively, of course, again, with such and such amount of labor. And you find, indeed, that they, I mean, how else it could be, they become resonance states. Now, there is something funny happens with immediately or very close to this point with this resonance state, and that is, let me just deviate. Actually, this is probably the only thing which I have time left for, deviate into a bit of numerology. So these are already that the masses are in this integrable point have analytic expressions. These are components of entries of the Perron-Frobenius eigenvector of the Cartan matrix. So this is they are built of some funny cosines, and here are numerical values. So these are masses of these two particles measured in the mass of lightest particle. And one immediately sees that this mass is very close to twice mass of the lightest particle. I already mentioned that it's close to the threshold, but it also says that this particle A3 can be interpreted as weakly bound states of two particles A1. Indeed, this difference, sort of binding energy, is really small. Now, here, this is very fine, but here we remember that in 1 plus 1 dimensions, if you have a weakly coupled bound state of two particles, you have also a weakly coupled bound state of three particles, four particles, six particles, and whatever number of particles. That's just a result of solving this equation, because for weakly coupled bound states, you can replace any kind of interaction by something point-like. And again, they are weakly coupled, so they move slowly. Non-relativistic approximation is fine. So this happens to be, again, as you know, integrable model. And one can compute the spectrum of bound states. And it has this form. And so we expect to have on top of two particle bound, weakly coupled bound state, three particle, four particle, and so forth. And indeed, looking at this other components of the Piron-Frobenius matrix, we observe that some of them, not all of them, some of them are close to integers. 3, 4, 5. All right? Good. It goes beyond that. All right? So if I compute the differences between this, which we decided to think of as the three particle bound state, four particle, five particle bound state differences, right? So these are binding energies. Here are the numerics. And here are the prediction of that integrable model, epsilon k, blah, blah, blah. You see that it's more or less exact. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of, you know, it is entertaining to me at least that E8, the Piron-Frobenius vector of E8 knows something about weakly coupled particles in 1 plus 1. Remark that no, this is the same, right? So we sort of maybe using. I mean, it looks like we can use the interpretation of these particles as bound states. So if I start now to decrease to make eta non-zero but slightly negative, the binding energy for this particle number 3 is going to decrease, and so this approximation is going to work better and better, right? And indeed, if and because they are weakly bound, this we expect that the resonances which appear this way are going to be very narrow. Well, basically because it's if it's a weakly coupled bound state, it's spread all over the universe, all over this room at least, and it's difficult for them to collect each other at the same place to form a different outgoing state. So, and indeed, I mean, it's difficult to study resonances numerically, but in this particular case, it's possible, and indeed, they are there, and they are resonances, and the width is abnormally small, and so if I am allowed to use this interpretation in terms of confined quarks. All these particles are, after all, are interpreted as mesons in this system of confined quarks. These particles are now analogs of tetra or tetra quarks or other exotic states, and it's not really QCD, but at least we have here an advantage of having a machinery to analyze not only molecule built of two mesons, more complicated molecule which is three mesons, four mesons, and so forth, sexta quarks, and so forth in some controlled environment. So this is one of the one of the unexpected outcomes of this simple analysis. This study is underway, so I'm not going to report much details. What's that?
You say the resonances disappear, the poles leave the principal sheet. In your picture, where do they go?
I didn't read this slide since.
Second last sentence.
Oh yeah, the how they disappear. This is a complicated question. This is a complicated question. Yeah, I'm trying to think if I can. If I can spell it in all right, right. It is complicated. It's more or less clear how this happens, but it's complicated. They basically, after all, they are interpreted as bound states of many particles, right? So they are going to merge with the multiparticle thresholds. That's why they sort of hit multiparticle thresholds and go to the higher sheets of the Riemann surface associated with those branch cuts. So it's complicated, and I really don't have good machinery for this. This is essentially a many body problem, which is I shown you few seconds ago the kind of caricature version of many body problem here, which is weakly coupled things, but here we don't have this approximation, and understanding many body problem in non-integrable situation, of course, is something complicated. All right, so these are some sort of predictions. I can show similar phenomenon with other when another particle admit a given get interpretation in terms of weakly coupled. So some resonances are interpreted in this way as tetra quark and stuff. There are of course lots of different resonances. There are some puzzles which I'm skipping of course here. So let me just go right to the summary. Which is sort of just like I say it. It's going to be a commercial for this Ising field theory as a rich theory, which sort of deserves attention as a theoretical thing. And on top of that, unlike today most of theoretical things, it missed some tests against numerical and even laboratory, as I mentioned, experiments. All right, so it's I think 55 minutes for 55 slides. And so thank you very much.
Gracias. Could you say a few words about the inelastic components?
Inelastic component. I can say it's very little that is known about it, but some things are known. One can do some perturbative analysis around integrable points, and in both cases, some results, very fragmentary results, are obtained. In particular, I was planning to discuss high energy scattering in some domain, but I can tell you more. But if you're asking general question, do we understand it? No.
Maybe I'll ask you later.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you have the stretch bosons, which are analogous to QCD. Do they arrange themselves in Rege trajectories? Manipulated by energies?
There is, instead of Rege trajectories, of course, you don't have a spin here. So Rege trajectories can be only Rege trajectories. But yes, I mean, in the domain which I refused to discuss, the domain where you could consider the confining interaction as weak, and so the spectrum admits description in terms of some sort of confining equation describing confining forces, similar to two-dimensional QCD Toft model. And it's less controllable approximation, but then again, it's possible to do that. I didn't touch that, but it's less controllable, but on the other hand, it's more controllable because unlike two-dimensional QCD, we have some laboratory stuff to compare results, in particular this question about the resonance decays and stuff. Yeah, but that's something which is in the shade, not explicit. Yeah.
Okay. More question?
Yeah. So if you're precisely at the point where two poles and one zero is collide. If you are precisely at the point where two poles and one zero collide,
yes.
Does it mean you have one less particle than nearby region?
No. These are just pictorial representation. What you have is that if you have two poles and one zero, they all merge to each other. At this exact point, you have just a simple pole. All right, you have some function which looks like this. It's 1 over z times z minus epsilon 1, z minus epsilon 2, and in particular case, epsilon 1 equals to epsilon 2.
So it's just
the
pole.
Yeah, it's a pole which has the right residue from my point of view. Right, but the only thing is what is important is that these two things have to vanish together. All right, so otherwise unitarity would be in problem.
In trying to understand your analogy, I got confused on some very basic point. So you make an analogy between QCD and this Ising field theory.
Yes.
So are we to think of the field theory as a 1 plus 1 dimensional theory in that analogy?
Yes.
And so that the 3 plus 1 in QCD corresponds to the 1 plus 1 in this case.
It's 1 plus 1 analog of QCD in
right,
some ways.
Right. And then so then what you call a kink, which is the analog of a quark, I guess.
Yes.
It's essentially a one-dimensional spatial structure in which a plus region goes over to a minus region.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Yes. And
because some of your pictures look two-dimensional with the kinks on it. I was a little confused by this.
No, I mean, in, from the point of view 1 plus 1, you have one-dimensional space, kinks, and because the regions between the kinks and the outside have different energy density, there is obviously a confining force between them. So nothing more fancy than that.
So qualitatively, much of this picture seems to be not particular to two dimensions. Is the three dimensions is something known?
I don't know what of this picture can be easily generalized to three dimensions. Like, for instance, this multiple bound states, which I discussed, if we are talking about that. All right, I mean, all this ideas about that, interpreting of some Z resonances as tetra quarks and so forth are, of course, fine. But if you want to make some quantitative comparison, you need to solve the problem. And the two-body problem you can solve in 3, 4, and even 26 dimensions, but if you, I mean, it's well. First of all, it's no longer true in four dimensions that if you have weakly bound two particle bound state that you necessarily have three. It's no longer true. Of course, it depends very much on the details, and I must confess, I still don't understand what details are really important for forming multi-body bounds.
Experimentally, do we know, say, how many masses there are, if it's just a non-magnetic field, for example?
Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that. If you're talking about three plus one dimensions.
Yeah, three-dimensionalizing with magnetic fields. So.
Oh, I don't think there is enough experiment. There is any detailed numerical data which concerns the spectrum. Even stable particles. Well, I mean, some part of stable particle spectrum is known, but not resonances is something which is very difficult. It is in the, it's even in two dimensions. Hunting for resonances is difficult.
Have anyone tried to implement the resurgence sort of formalism here? There are some efforts of trying to improve the perturbation theory such that you can resum it to exact answer. And usually they include like the trivial vacuum and then kink anti-kink and higher up. Has anyone tried in this perturbation business here to push?
Yeah, people tried that. It depends on, there is a spectrum of questions here, right? And depending on the question, people tried, of course, perturbative approaches. This is not exactly trivial because basically, to do perturbation theory, you have to have zeros approximation and perturbation, right? And for instance, for zero magnetic field, the zeros approximation, of course, is free fermions, and the perturbation must be spin operator spin operator, spin density, and it's not exactly local in terms of fermions. So there is no obvious analog of Feynman perturbation theory. You have to do it old-fashioned way with all these problems, with untangling the disconnected diagrams and all this stuff. Partly this is overcame for some quantities. For more interesting quantities, it's in the way. I don't think there is a very efficient machinery here. So it's not that you. It's not that. Yeah.
There is a machine downstairs. There will be some food now downstairs. Maybe.
Oh, we will try.
Yeah, we'll try downstairs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's thank Sasha again for the.